This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company on the Country Hour today. I'm going to take a deep dive into the goat meat industry and have a look at what's driving demand. But before I do that, I do have some news because multinational food corporation Cargill has finished its acquisition of Tees Beef Processing. So the company put out a statement today outlining that Cargill now holds 100% ownership of Tees Australia and Tees USA and has said that this follows approval of all regulatory requirements, including approval from the Australian Foreign Investment Review Board. Andrew McPherson has been appointed the CEO of Tees and he will assume the leadership role effective immediately based in Brisbane and he'll be responsible for driving Tees operations under the new ownership. And we'll be bringing you any more details on this acquisition as it comes to light. In 2024 though, Australia produced more goat meat than ever before. So the quantity is there, but what about the quality? Beef and lamb are graded for quality, but no such system exists for goat meat. But should it? Madeline McCosker filed this report.
Goat meat production is up, jumping 47% in just 1 year. Figures from Meat and Livestock Australia show most of that is exported to countries like the US, South Korea, China, and the Caribbean. Dr. Janine Teese is a senior analyst with supply chain consultancy Greenleaf Enterprises. She says driving that demand is a quality-focused segment of the market known as conscious consumers.
And typically within that conscious consumer, it's about environmental sustainability, how it was raised, different management activities involved in it, and also the use of hormones, growth promotants, antibiotics. And goat fits that conscious consumer perfectly, which is why we've seen in the likes of California and the US a massive demand for goat meat.
In Australia, the vast majority of goats are rangeland, meaning they're not produced from a managed breeding program, but rather they're captured from the wild and taken to meatworks for processing. Across domestic and international markets, rangeland goats are often seen as free range, which Dr. Teese says is attractive for those conscious consumers.
The fact that there's no antibiotics and no hormones, sort of they're calling it like a never ever, it's not being touched with additives. Particularly in some other countries, the traceability on what's happened with along the chain is not as thorough as Australia. So that's something that they're looking at as well. Yeah, it's rather than not handling, but just purely it's a free-range lifestyle.
More than half of global goat meat exports by volume are from Australia, outpacing competitors like Kenya and Ethiopia, which represent 22% and 13% respectively. Despite having a large foothold in the international market, research from MLA shows that only 5% of Australian goat meat finds its way into the domestic market. Dr. Teese said consumers in Australia are looking for a meatier product.
So they want to have a little bit of bone and a lot of meat. So it's important to have meatier goats selected for and then available through the supply chain.
Through her work with different supply chains, Dr. Teese said consistent supply of meat needs to be a priority.
Having the ability to have weekly supply all year round is something that a lot of the domestic supply chains have been working to build. If we've identified, like there's an opportunity in those cuisines which are growing and people are looking for, then how do we make sure that the goat producers in Australia are able to supply into that market? Because once you're on the menu, you've got to be able to supply for that quantity that they need and consistency.
The recent growth in Australia's production is a result of favourable seasonal conditions and meatworks expanding their processing capabilities. Anita Dennis is a Western Queensland goat producer, and in recent years, she's taken a more hands-on approach with breeding and genetics.
I think that's the positivity of the goat market, is that is such a variance in what we can produce and we can hit into different markets throughout the world as well as local markets. And we've started putting better genetics in. And we've used the assistance of KidPlan to help select our genetics that we're putting into our rangeland goats. And we're growing a more of a meatier animal, and we've been able to turn off our goats a lot earlier than what we previously have been able to do in the past.
As the industry works to ensure reliable supply in Aussie butcher shops, consistency in taste is also key. In the 1990s, declining beef consumption prompted the red meat industry to develop Meat Standards Australia, or MSA. It's a voluntary national eating quality system, which was extended to lamb in 2021. The system works to ensure the eating quality of red meat and allows meatworks to provide feedback to producers. But nothing has been developed for goat meat. Some within the industry are hoping this year's introduction of mandatory individual electronic identification, or EID tags, in goats could be the start of a similar system for goat meat. Glenda Henry is chair of Queensland Goat Producers, and she also breeds goats in central Queensland.
The only advantage for us in actually EID tagging them, because there's a lot of expense in that, would be actually getting proper kill sheets like you do from, you know, you get your reports back from your cattle, but you don't from your goats. Until you've actually got grading, there's no guarantee when you go to buy goat meat what you're going to actually get. If they have a bad experience, you're never going to get them to go back again.
But not all goat producers agree that it's a priority. Rather than MSA grading, Anita Dennis thinks the priority should be consistent supply into supermarkets.
I really don't think MSA grading is really driving the goat industry at the moment. The butchers, when I go away, I pop in there and I speak to them. I ask them about, you know, do you think we need MSA grading for goats? And to tell you the truth, they just want product on the shelf. So it's something that isn't there within the market. I think there's so many other things that the goat industry needs before MSA grading.
The Goat Industry Council of Australia works with government to develop policy for the sector across all breeds. Its president, John Falkenhagen, says the organisation has no position on MSA grading, but whatever system is developed needs to be fit for purpose.
MSA may not work for the goat industry because of the way that it's cooked, the way that its supply chains work. But we may have something else that's unique, and I can't define that. That will happen over time.
That report from Madeline McCosker. If you want to learn more on this, there is an online article. You can head to the ABC Rural website to get more on that story. It is 13 minutes past 12. Up next, major supermarkets are again being accused of undercutting growers.
Before the sun rises, your local ABC team are starting their day getting ready to help you start yours. Join us for local news and community happenings. ABC Breakfast, weekday mornings on ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
The major supermarkets say they're strong supporters of Australian-grown products after grain and legume growers have accused them of undercutting them. Judy Plath is a soybean grower and agronomist in the Bundaberg region. She believes the supermarkets are using inferior imported products on their private label soy milk.
The biggest challenge is that consumers trust Coles and Woolies to support Australian farmers. So when they grab that private label peanut butter or soy milk, they assume that Coles and Woolies bought that soy or peanut butter from Australian farmers. But these farmers are here to say today that our product, Australian made, Australian grown, soy for soy milk or peanuts for peanut butter, is being forced to compete with inferior imported products. And we can't compete. We are a first world nation. We pay much bigger costs than Argentina or China, yet Coles and Woolworths expect us to compete on a supposedly fair playing field with inferior imported product.
What do you want to see from the supermarkets?
We're here to ask the supermarkets today to make it possible for Australian product to compete fairly with their cheaper imported private label brands. Whether that's peanut butter or soy milk, Coles and Woolies have it in their power to make it possible for us to compete fairly. Stop using imported, inferior, cheaper product in their private label range, or make it possible for us to compete fairly with their imported range. And that can be done by not charging Australian product the ridiculous shelf promotional fees that Coles and Woolies currently charge to Australian product.
Do you have any specific ask of consumers today?
If the consumer wants to support Australian farmers, unfortunately they've got to look at the label and look for product of Australia, and it needs to be 99 or 100% Australian. Otherwise, we are being diluted by imported ingredients. Our biggest frustration as Australian farmers is that we're being forced by Coles and Woolies to compete with farmers overseas who are not subject to the same strict regulatory obligations that we are. We have to make sure that we treat our staff correctly, that we pay the correct wages, that we use chemicals safely, that we don't pollute the reef. All of these costs that Australian farmers incur are not being incurred by these Chinese and Argentine farmers that Coles and Woolies are favouring over us.
Have you been in contact with the new Food Farmers Commissioner about this?
Some of my fellow farmers and I recently had a meeting with Stephen Bennett, the member for Burnett, about this very issue, and we were very pleased with Steve's concerns. Steve Bennett took our concerns seriously, and he has approached the Queensland Food Farmers Commissioner to arrange a meeting on our behalf to discuss this issue further.
Were you hopeful, given the Supermarket Pricing Committee, that we wouldn't be talking about this in November 2025?
I've been working with farmers in the fruit and vegetable industry and now the grain legume industry for 25 years. And in that time, I've seen more supermarket inquiries than I'd like to know about. Every single inquiry outlines the fact that Coles and Woolies use bully boy tactics to force Australian farmers to take lower prices. Coles and Woolies use those bully boy tactics, and every supermarket inquiry has outlined that. Yet nothing changes. In 2025, it is time for Coles and Woolies to actually do the right thing. It's time for Coles and Woolies to stop the lip service about supporting Aussie farmers and actually back us up with fair policies that we can compete with.
Judy Plath is a soybean grower and agronomist in the Bundaberg region. Now, it's already been an unnerving year for Queensland's peanut industry as Bega sold its processing plants to Crumpton Group. Grower Dean Cayley is worried his industry could face even more pressure if competing with overseas products.
I suppose the cost of putting Australian product on the shelves, if it wants to be at eye height for consumers to look at, we're getting penalised a fee to do that. Which, you know, as Australian farmers, Coles and Woolworths should basically scrap that fee to make it fair for the consumer too, you know, and we're not paying that so-called Australian premium for it. It shouldn't be a premium charged on that.
It's been a pretty disruptive year for the peanut industry, especially with Bega closing its processing facilities. What more is needed to support the industry so farmers aren't walking away?
As I said, it's just our input costs now. Look at our electricity costs, probably 50% higher than where they used to be. Water charges, fertiliser charges just seems to be coming up and up every year. Even our labour costs now, cost of machinery to do the same job, well, the money's not there. So they really need government needs to get behind and look at some of these costs. My insurance costs, I've had to trim some of my insurance. Some of my sheds now aren't insured because it just becomes unaffordable. So if we keep going on this path we're going on, my young fellow finished the school this year, talked him into doing an apprenticeship, trying to get him away from farming. So, you know, we're a multi-generational farm. There's a lot of the farmers behind me are multi-generational. Whether their kids or their grandkids want to take over, it's probably going to be cost prohibitive to do it. Our land price, another one that's cost prohibitive here. It's making it harder and harder, and the more you sort of look into it, well, do government really want farmers here at all?
What can a consumer do to help you guys?
I know the cost of living hurts everybody, but look, if they can go there and buy the Australian-made stuff, obviously it's going to help us.
How many growers have walked away from the peanut industry because of imports and competing, you know, with these cheaper products?
Oh, look, there's been a guy there that his grandfather started over in Cumbria, Kingaroya, and he's not growing any. There's probably, I wouldn't have a clue on the numbers, but it'd be a dozen or more. We used to do crisping potatoes, even that industry. There used to be 25 growers in Queensland, New South Wales. there's probably five left. So, yeah, it's been a downhill trend.
It's Bundaberg peanut grower Dean Cayley. Now, a Woolworths spokesperson says the company uses Australian ingredients where it can. They added, "We always provide country of origin labelling on our own brand food products to help customers make an informed choice." While a Coles representative says more than 97% of fresh produce comes from Australian producers, but for frozen, canned and select pantry items, we source from both Australian and international suppliers to ensure consistent year-round availability.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app, this is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Going to take you to the north now, to the Burdekin region, because it's the latest to be hit with locust swarms and nymphs. So that there's six sites on cane farms confirmed in the past week. And this comes after the swarms of locusts and large population of nymphs have moved through parts of central, western and northwest Queensland in recent months. There's also concern the insect will move to cropping areas in the central highlands in the coming weeks if favourable weather conditions continue. Queensland's Locust Commissioner Michelle Smith tells Madeline McCosker spraying won't be possible due to a lack of approved insecticides that can be used on the crop.
Yes, so we've got our first report from locust in cane last Friday. So it's all been fairly recent. There's a lot of flurry of activity. So really appreciative of the cane industry and Agforce as well for getting on top of this one and the agronomists. DPI have only received, I think, six now formal reports of locust activity from growers. And they range from Tully up in the north all the way down to Proserpine in the south. But we are aware that there's a lot of other reports that have been put through via sugar industry reps and the agronomists. So we've contacted all those landholders who've reported that activity. Currently, the locusts aren't widespread across that whole region. They seem to be, even on the affected properties, the nymphs are sort of appearing in small but very dense patches. So again, we're strongly encouraging landholders to report any locust activity. We want to keep monitoring the abundance and distribution, and that information is going to be really critical for assessing that potential risk of significant economic damage in the coming months. They haven't necessarily always been a problem in cane. Because these are native species, they're always typically present in low numbers, even in those cane-growing areas. But, I mean, again, we've had those really ideal breeding conditions. But I think one of the issues we have for cane is there's no currently registered insecticides for controlling migratory locust in the crops. We do obviously have several products containing fipronil that can be used on pastures, which can then be applied to adjacent grassed areas if you know, landholders have got pasture as well as cropping. And obviously with the reef regulations and everything else, you know, the use of fipronil, we've got to be pretty careful. It's got to be used in accordance with the label directions and, you know, adhering to all buffer requirements. So where DPI is sort of going to be working now with the sugar industry to assess whether or not an emergency use permit application will be needed to be, you know, applied through the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority. That's why we are really encouraging growers to report to us, and then we can get that bit of a geographical picture of what's happening on the ground and then provide that information with the industry to help them decide whether or not they do think that it's worthwhile going through an EUP. The only other thing, obviously, with the cane, I think, would be that if those eggs are disturbed, and I think that's one of the reasons we probably haven't seen large numbers of locusts in cane, there's a lot more preparation of the soil. If those egg beds are turned over, then the eggs will be exposed to ants and other predators and more of a risk of desiccation and dying off. So if property owners are concerned and there's an opportunity for them to do any of that sort of level of soil cultivation, that's another way they might be able to break that life cycle by if they see adult locusts doing or laying any eggs in the crop.
Are there any concerns for other crops in the region?
I think one of the key alerts we'll be putting out over the next week or so will be for the Central Highlands and that cropping region, like our key strategic cropping area, because we're now seeing locust activity to the east and also to the west. And we do know that the conditions through the Central Highlands have been fairly good for locust survival as well. We are actively monitoring swarms just to determine where they're going, because there is potential maybe that some of those swarms that have been detected west of Claremont could start heading southeast. Again, just keeping an eye on prevailing winds, but definitely recommending that people in those areas with crops in. I know that they're, you know, just finishing off harvesting the winter crops, and we'll be looking at planting summer crops soon. So really quite critical that they be really vigilant in their cropping areas and just be monitoring for the first signs of anything coming up. Yeah, having populations of migratory locusts on the east and the west of those areas and knowing that the Central Highlands is probably their key preferred habitat just means that the risks are there and we just got to be really, really vigilant to try and get on top of it before it does escalate to a point where we're getting sort of some significant economic damage to those cropping regions.
Right, so there's some concern for the cropping areas in the Central Highlands that these migratory locusts might make their way southeast towards those cropping areas.
Yeah, I think there's no guarantees at the moment. We don't know, but we're certainly trying to put the alert out there, make people vigilant, get them out there in the crops, having a look and just seeing and then just reporting anything. And it doesn't need to be people in those cropping areas. Anyone driving along roadsides, if you see anything, just let us know because the department really needs to be getting a good visual map and good representation of exactly where those populations are, especially the swarms. We can do some control of nymph populations if they're identified in those pastoral areas, but any of that early warning just gives everybody a bit of an opportunity to get prepared to tackle the problem if it does start to head towards that Central Highlands region.
What's the latest on the locust and nymph situation across Western Queensland?
The last level of control that we've done was sort of in that mid-October area. We went out west of Claremont and did some treatment spraying of fipronil over some properties there. So that was quite successful. We had some good reports through that was that we'd managed to target a lot of the nymphs there, and also we got some fledgling locusts as well. The reality is we wouldn't have targeted absolutely everything, so we've been consequently calling landholders in that area and relying on them to respond to us to let us know what's been going on. Then in mid-October, we got reports back through from the Southern Flinders Shire. So as I'm sure everyone will remember, we had some reports coming through from that area in sort of June, July and August this year. They were swarms that were reported then. And then recently, we just got a couple of reports of some swarms and one property that had some nymphs. Rang a lot of properties in that area in that Southern Flinders Shire, and nobody's sort of reporting anything. There's been a couple of swarms observed, but not large numbers. But like I said, that was probably 3 weeks ago, but really encouraged people in that Southern Flinders area and then also into that Barcaldine and Winton areas where those locusts were quite visible back in, you know, in July, August, to let us know if they do see anything. Also just had a recent report this week from that Claremont area again, very similar area to where we did the spray in mid-October, and it appears as though there's some swarms around that area again. We've also done some cold calling in that area, spoken to a few landholders, and pretty much everyone we've spoken to has said that, yes, they've seen some swarms. Not a lot of people have reported that they've seen nymphs in the last couple of weeks, but there is some reports of swarms in those areas. So, again, just really encouraging landholders to report anything they see through our reporting channels so that, yeah, we can get a bit of an idea of what that distribution and abundance is and where they're actually travelling to.
I am curious as well about the impact of recent weather and how that might be impacting numbers. It's been quite hot over some periods here out west, you know, temperatures up in the 40s in some areas. We had some rain over the weekend. So what does this kind of variable weather mean for populations, for breeding?
Yeah, it's a bit hit and miss. Essentially, the migratory locusts require about 40 mil of rain each month for the soil to maintain that level of moisture for the eggs to survive. So those higher numbers are going to be good in regards to, you know, that soil moisture drying out and therefore potentially desiccating any eggs that are in the ground at the moment. But depending on where the eggs were laid, any of that, you know, sporadic rainfall that has happened, if it does dampen the soil where those eggs have been laid, then there's potential for those to survive until, you know, they are ready to hatch. So it has been ideal breeding conditions. We have had a relatively mild winter and that sporadic rainfall. And it really will depend now on what happens over the next couple of weeks as to whether or not we get those early rains coming through and just the extent of the distribution, I suppose, of the rain.
Michelle Smith is Queensland's Locust Commissioner, speaking with Madeline McCosker. Now, locust sightings can be reported by phone on 13 25 23. That's 13 25 23. Or you can head online to the Department of Primary Industries website and you can make a report on there.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
So Buffalo Grass is back in the spotlight because Queensland MP Bob Katter has questioned the Federal Agriculture Minister over the push to declare it a weed of national significance. So Buffalo Grass is prized by the cattle industry as drought-resilient pasture, but environmental groups argue it threatens biodiversity. During question time, Mr. Katter urged Julie Collins to rule out listing the grass as a weed.
So the member for Kennedy has the call.
Agriculture Minister, over 25,000 square kilometres in northwest Queensland, Australia's cattle heartland, is now overrun by the prickly acacia weed tree. In contrast, buffalo grass now covers vast tracts of what were once barren wastelands. Buffalo's restoring river banks, deepening streams, many of which are now flowing again. Wouldn't you agree then with prominent Queensland Ag Force President Shane McCarthy, fifth generation farmer, that only a government official cloistered in the Canberra kindergarten could ban buffalo grass? For heaven's sake, Minister, will you put a stop on this madness urgently? Otherwise, won't you preside over a 7% drop in Australia's fifth largest export industry, beef?
Call to the Minister for Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the member for Kennedy genuinely for his interest in this issue, and he has raised it with me personally, and I am well aware of it. And he also understands how critical the beef industry is to Australia. It is a very significant industry. Just a few weeks ago, we had a conversation about the buffalo grass, and on the matter of buffalo grass raised by the member, what I would say is that we recognise that buffalo grass is a valuable pasture for cattle in northern Australia, particularly in Queensland and the Northern Territory. The process that is currently underway is identifying new national weed priorities, and it's assessing buffalo grass in targeted areas where there's potential adverse environmental impact, such as national parks. Can I also say to the member, any recommended management action would not adversely affect buffalo grass in agricultural production areas where it's deliberately planted, not considered a weed, and continues to provide benefit to livestock. Any future decisions on weed priorities, including a decision on this particular one, would be made collaboratively by all state and territory governments, along with the Commonwealth, because as the member would be aware, of course, state and territories are responsible for the management of pests and weed invasions in their local jurisdictions. The member would also understand that this industry is really significant for regional jobs across Australia, for our national economy as well. And we do understand the importance of the beef industry that the member referred to and the need to seize the opportunities that are there for the beef industry. As the member would know, I have been up to Beef Australia in the great state of Queensland, his home state, as has our assistant minister. And indeed, in the last budget, we provided $12 million for Beef 2027. Beef is, of course, as is quite rightly pointed out, a very significant export for Australia. Indeed, it's our most valuable agriculture export. And beef exports are currently up 62% since we came to government to $16 billion last financial year. $16 billion. So a very significant industry that we value and that we are working with to ensure that they reap the opportunities of the hard work that they have been putting into providing a great Australian product and exporting it across the globe.
Federal Agriculture Minister Julie Collins responding to a question from Member for Kennedy Bob Katter during parliamentary question time yesterday. Weather's up next.
It was 20 years ago that Spicks and Specks began to play.
The anniversary tour is back with 8 new episodes.
Correct.
Join Adam, Miff and Alan for brand new Spicks and Specks. Sunday nights on ABC TV and ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's time to check in on the weather now, and Baden Gilbert joins me from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Baden.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
How are you?
Yes, no, I'm doing good. Enjoying a change from some of the previous week that we've had, a much more benign pattern for today, which makes my job a bit simpler.
Yeah. Are there any showers and storms around?
Really not much apart from around the central coast. Just a few showers and storms in play between roughly Mackay and Bowen. No huge totals out of them yet, but one or two places have dipped into the double digits. So they're not doing nothing, but they're just sort of puttering along out there. Beyond that, there's just a bit of cloud about eastern districts and not much else to say for Queensland for the moment, which makes a nice change.
Yeah. And what about in coming to the days and through the weekend and into next week? Is it going to stay benign or is there some changes coming?
There is a bit of a change coming. So as we go into tomorrow, we start to see the next trough enter Queensland from the southwest. And ahead of that, we could see some very isolated showers and storms that could be a bit gusty, particularly around places like Birdsville, but also about the southern Maranoa. Looks like focus areas for that activity on Friday, but it is quite isolated in nature. As we go into Saturday, it picks up a little bit more. We get an area of storms from the northwest of the state down towards the Darling Downs and a bit more shower activity in that before it actually turns a bit more rainy as we go into Sunday and makes its way towards the east coast, particularly about places in central Queensland and the Wide Bay, but also for parts of the southeast coast as well before that all clears off during Monday. There is also just another risk of severe thunderstorms near the New South Wales border on both Saturday and Sunday there. So we'll be keeping an eye on that as we get closer as well.
Yeah, and how will all this impact temperatures?
Temperatures, there is some changes with temperatures with this feature coming through. It'll be a little bit warmer than average ahead of the change. Through the interior, maybe up to 5 degrees above the November average. But then behind it, we swing the other way and we go around 5 degrees below the November average. Those extreme differences from averages quite... Sorry, try that again. Those differences from average aren't quite as strong near the coast, but it will still be a little bit warmer ahead of that change, a little bit cooler behind it, particularly for the interior on Sunday, where we'll see most of that cool air coming through. It doesn't quite make it up into the far north Queensland or Cape York Peninsula, though, so we still do have some ongoing heatwave conditions, particularly about areas from Weipa northwards, but we'll be watching those in coming days. There could be some little lumps and bumps in how significant that is, but broadly it's still going to be pretty hot until the end of next week.
So in terms of that severe heat wave, what temperatures can people in the peninsula expect?
Yeah, it depends where you are exactly what you're going to get. For those on the east coast of the peninsula, places like Lockhart River and even a bit of Cowan, they're around that 34 to 35 degree mark for maximums. Well, meanwhile, if you're in Weipa on the west coast or Kawanyama, you could be seeing temps around that 37, 38, even reaching 39 degrees on some days. And that's with a lot of humid air coming into play as well. And that's part of the real reason we are seeing that heatwave warning trigger. It's not so much the hot during the day, although it is definitely hot during the day. It's also the hot overnight. You just don't get the chance for your body to recover. And that can lead up to a build-up of just fatigue from days and days of hot weather. But that is the build-up in far north Queensland. And we are going to see those temperatures eventually head back towards the mid-30s as we go into the back half of next week. So there is some changes coming, but they're still a little while away.
And in coastal waters, what can people expect?
Winds are actually pretty light on the coastals at the moment. We do have some east-southeasty winds about far north Queensland, but they're not super strong and tending more easterly about some parts down the remainder of the east coast. They could shift a bit more northerly, particularly about southern and central Queensland as we go into this weekend ahead of that trough approaching the coast, where they'll swing back round to more of a trade wind flow as we go into early next week.
And swells?
Swells, nothing major to talk about there really. Just the usual choppier sort of swell that we get along the east coast of Queensland, and no huge southerly swells coming up around area south of Gurrie in the next little while.
And just looking at the fire danger ratings, Gulf Country, Northern Goldfields and Upper Flinders and the Central Highlands and Coalfields are on high fire dangers. What is driving that?
Yeah, so at this time of year, there is just a lot of heat and there has been a bit of wind about. Not huge amounts of wind, but enough to pick those fire dangers up towards high, particularly in those areas that you mentioned about the northern and central interior. As we go into tomorrow and then Saturday, those places just ahead of that trough will see a bit of a pickup in those fire dangers. No extremes forecast, but definitely some broader areas of high through much of the interior before they ease back on Sunday.
And I guess, you know, just looking across the board, what are the main drivers at the moment with the weather?
In terms of drivers for the weather at the moment, we do broadly have the main thing that's driving particularly some of those above average temperatures that we seem to keep seeing in recent months has been the above average sea surface temperatures. Everything around us in the Coral Sea and the Gulf is sitting a bit warmer than it would otherwise be, and that's leading particularly to those warmer nights, not just warmer days, coming up particularly for those communities closer to the coast. We're still sitting in an Indian Ocean dipole phase as well, which leads to a bit of enhanced moisture across parts of Queensland, but that's going to trend towards neutral as we head towards the end of the year.
Baden, thank you so much for your time today.
That's all good. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Baden Gilbert, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. Now, in regards to the fire ban, local fire bans remain in place for 7 council areas across parts of North Queensland today. During fire bans, you are not allowed to light any fires in the open, but some exceptions do apply. There are more details about what you can and can't do during a fire ban, and a full list of the council areas that have bans in place today, you can find all of that at the Queensland Fire Department website, which is fire.qld.gov.au. That's fire.qld.gov.au.
The Ashes. And the cricket on.
Rushes in and bowls a yorker and bowls him.
ABC Sports Summer of Cricket on your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
Farmers, environmental groups and researchers are calling for national regulation to ban the sale of gazanias at Australian nurseries. While it's bright and colourful, these flowers, you know, they really are a popular garden plant, but it's also an invasive weed that's causing significant damage to farmland. The rapid spread of gazanias is making paddocks unviable, leaving farmers with significant economic losses. Jessica Schremer has this report.
Walking through some of Robin Schaefer's paddocks in South Australia's Riverland, it's a field of colourful flowering gazanias rather than crops. Where he usually would grow lentils or other legumes, the invasive weed has taken over.
They're getting a bigger and bigger problem every year as they're spreading out into our fields. They're becoming uncontrollable, and it's probably been in the last 5 or 6 years that they're really taking off, and because they're spreading a lot more along roadsides and they're moving out into the fields now. And we've had a couple of years where we've had good rains for them to germinate sort of in late spring once the crop dries off, and yeah, they've just exploded. And especially I guess our farming systems have changed a fair bit in the last 5 or 6 years as well, and we're growing more legumes, and they seem to really explode through those legume crops because there's less competition for them. We don't have as many herbicide options in there anyway, which tend to hold back a little bit.
What impact do they have on paddocks?
They're a very competitive plant for moisture and nutrition and that as well, and then we also believe they have some allelopathic effects of other plants as well. So they pretty much will take over the environment, and like where they grow, virtually nothing else will grow in the sort of immediate area around the plant. The seeds are very lightweight seeds, so they can get blown by the wind very easily, and they produce thousands and thousands of seeds. Each plant will produce thousands and thousands of seeds that are then blown around, and because they're a small seed, they're relatively suited to our no-till systems as well because they don't need much soil cover for them to germinate either. And there's very few herbicide options for controlling them. So once they start getting established, you virtually can't kill them. You get to keep getting more and more, and they get thicker and thicker and spread further and further and just outcompete the crop.
The destructive nature of gazanias comes at a significant financial loss for producers, as Mr. Schaefer explains.
Some farmers have actually pulled paddocks out of production because they can't grow a crop in it anymore. This is like wall-to-wall gazania. A weed of this sort of significance shouldn't be allowed to be sold within Australia.
Native to South Africa, gazanias were first imported to Australia in the 1950s and 1970s as low-maintenance garden plants. They since have spread across Australia's vast landscape through garden-based cuttings and seed dispersals. And while gazanias are a declared invasive weed in South Australia and banned from sale, they still can be bought in nurseries outside the state. Barry Barmra, Landcare Project Officer Andrew Wallach, compares gazanias' harmful habits to carp in Australian river systems.
They are a colourful cancer, very insidious, very quick moving. If you can think of it as sucking the life out of our soils, and it's really taking away our natural resources that for a lot of farmers have taken a long time to build, and then to have that taken away within a season or two, it's really horrific. horrific. And it's going to hit the hip pocket, but more so, it's really hurting the environment as far as areas that are taking over and potentially natural native species we're going to be losing. And we don't know what else it's affecting either, really. There's so much unknown about it because they are travelling so quickly.
He says seeing Gesenia sold in nurseries doesn't make any sense.
It's insanity. It really is. I mean, we're not alone. South Australia has a weed problem, and pretty much anywhere southern South Australia I've seen them, right through many areas of northern Victoria, their problem, certainly in western New South Wales. But you know what? A bit like a cane toad, they're just going to keep spreading insidiously. And as long as we keep saying they're pretty, don't bother controlling them, we've got a problem. And look, selling effectively a noxious weed is just bonkers.
The Invasive Species Council's Engagement Director, Imogen Epsworth, is calling on the federal government to introduce national regulation to stop the sale of invasive garden plants.
Gesenias are a really great example of why Australia really needs to change how we deal with garden plants that can become invasive. We've got over 30,000 introduced plant species in Australia, and unfortunately the vast majority have never been assessed for their weed risk. And even where they have been assessed for their weed risk, like Gesenia, we've only got patchy responses from government, so that they're still legal to sell in some parts of the country or maybe only banned in specific states, like Gesenia being banned in South Australia.
While Gesenias are recognised as an environmental weed in Victoria, Queensland, Tasmania and New South Wales for some species, they still can be sold at nurseries. Ms Epsworth says consumers are left in the dark.
We really need to change how we manage invasive garden plants. We need to do a proper risk assessment, and then we need to regulate the sale of them so that you and I don't need a botany degree to work out when we buy a plant in the local nursery that we're buying something safe for our environment.
The nursery sector's national peak body, Greenlife Industry Australia, said Gesenias could still be legally grown and sold in most parts of Australia. Its director of RDE and biosecurity said in a written statement,
"While not nationally prohibited, several jurisdictions discourage the use of Gesenias because of their invasive potential, and future restrictions are under consideration."
Meanwhile, a recent study led by Dr. Ali Bashwa's Weed Science Group at La Trobe University found Gesenias were more resilient than previously thought.
They are quite acclimatized to our harsh climates in terms of high temperatures and really dry environments. And that's what makes their management extremely difficult, because these plants are inherently tolerant to a lot of different chemical herbicides, and that's why we can't really control them.
A spokesperson for the Department of Climate Change, Energy, the Environment and Water said in a statement,
"The Australian government is developing a threat abatement plan in collaboration with state and territory governments. The plan will set out a range of tools to address the threat, which may include regulation. Given the complexity of managing the threat from escaped garden and pond weeds, we anticipate that it will take several months to develop the draft threat abatement plan."
But if you are a keen gardener and love the look of the brightly coloured daisy-like Gesenia, Ms Epsworth recommends planting native species.
I think particularly about our beautiful native daisy species, our paper buttons and everlastings. They're just as gorgeous. They are just as adapted to harsh conditions like Gesenia is. And you're planting something then that's native to your area, that's going to help the birds, bees and butterflies in your space. And you're not going to be planting an invasive plant.
Invasive Species Council Engagement Director Imogen Epsworth finishing that story by Jessica Schremer. If you'd like to read more on that story, you can head online to the ABC Rural website, which is abc.net.au/rural. And if you like the stories that you're hearing on the Country Hour today, did you know the Queensland Country Hour is on the ABC Listen app? It's free to download and lets you choose when and where to listen. You can listen live right now or catch up on these interviews and programs you may have missed. You also get our great audio features, and you can take it anywhere, anytime. Just head to the App Store on your device or to abc.net.au/listen on your computer to download it. Once you have it, at the bottom of the ABC Listen app, you'll see a little search icon. Tap on that, and from there, you can search for your local ABC station or the Queensland Country Hour. And while you're there, hit the little heart symbol to favourite the show, and you're set to go.
As each day begins,
get the facts you need to stay informed.
Every day, across your day,
stay with Australia's trusted news source.
Stay in the know with ABC News.
Go to news.abc.net.au or download the ABC News app.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app.
Water from record floods in Thargomindah and southwestern Queensland in March this year has flown down the Bulloo River and into the Bulloo Overflow and into the internationally significant wetlands of Narea-Karya-Pundi Swamp. It's a rare occurrence for water to be in the region, prompting senior ecologists to conduct a waterbird survey, which has been the first in 35 years. River ecologist and conservationist biologist Professor Richard Kingsford says they did an aerial water survey last week, and initial results suggest there could be 10,000 birds there.
Yeah, look, it was really exciting. We flew down from Thargomindah last week down to where the Bulloo overflows from Queensland into New South Wales. And really what we're trying to do is get some idea of the biodiversity of that area for New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service, and using our aerial surveys to count water birds there. And it's such a huge area, it's really important to cover with an aeroplane.
Why did you cover it for the first time?
Look, it was a great opportunity because we had this massive flood in that came through in March 2025, and once it went down the river, it spreads out into this extensive floodplain that's the Bulloo River floodplain, and then goes over the border and down into almost a massive lake that's created east of Tipperburra. And so just thinking about how important that is and the areas of National Park that are in there, as well as we know that Narriera has Karya-Pundi Swamp there, which is now a wetland of international significance under the Ramsar Convention. It was just a great opportunity to collect some data on the biodiversity, given we expected large numbers of water birds to be there.
So how did you actually do the water bird survey? Can you just talk me through what that day looked like?
Yeah, sure. Because it's such a massive area, what we do is we create these transects that crisscross east to west across Karya-Pundi Swamp and also the Bulloo Overflow. Each one of these is 200 metres wide, and so we're counting water birds flying at about 50 metres in a Cessna across there with one observer on either side of the plane, and we're counting like race callers, I guess, into dictaphones and identifying, you know, more than 50 different water bird species as we fly across there. And we must have spent 3 to 4 hours trying to go back and forth there running these transects, which allow us then to extrapolate and get an estimate of the total numbers of water birds in the whole of Karya-Pundi Swamp and the Bulloo Overflow.
And what did you see, or what did you recall of the birds that you did see?
Look, it's just an incredible place, because what you find is that particularly where it's shallow, there are large numbers of water birds, and we're talking about grey teal and pink-eared duck, but also threatened species like freckled duck. But also we have swans breeding up there and swamp hens breeding, and there's really a rich diversity of different types of water birds there. The ones that are feeding on vegetation and invertebrates. It was actually quite interesting that we didn't see any cormorants. We saw one pelican, which indicates that, you know, the fish numbers haven't actually built up there, but we'd expect that to happen as time goes on and we start to see more and more of those fish-eating birds, because those fish populations take time to build up and breed up into such an extensive habitat area.
Were you surprised how much water's there?
Look, I've flown over the Bulloo Overflow in the 1990s, and it's such a big area, but I guess this is the first time we've really done a comprehensive survey, and absolutely surprised at how much water there was there. And also, given this flood happened in March, that there's still that vast expanse of water now, you know, late October. And it's obviously going to last quite a lot longer because there's still, we could see some fence posts sticking out. So there's quite a bit of depth in some parts of it.
So what do you do now with those results? Like what happens? You've got to collate it?
Yeah, so now what we need to do is we transcribe our counts. We'll then put them together and then estimate what area we actually covered in our transects, and that gives us an opportunity to provide an extrapolation of the diversity and numbers of water birds that are on the two big bits of water, which is the Buller Overflow and then Karrapundi Swamp, which is a little bit more northwest of the Buller Overflow.
Do you have any initial inclinations of what you may kind of surmise?
It's really quite difficult to work it out, but certainly in the thousands and probably tens of thousands of water birds, I would suspect by the time we've done our counts, just because, you know, it's such a vast area.
Are you suggesting that you've counted tens of thousands in that 3 or 4 hours that you were flying around there?
Well, it would be, once we extrapolate out, we would have counted probably hundreds to maybe 1,000, but because we do probably about 10%, it may well be that by the time we do an estimate for the total numbers, we're looking at tens of thousands of water birds.
What's the importance of recording birds and doing these surveys?
Well, the one thing we do know is that these water birds are a really good environmental indicator of the health of our rivers and our wetlands, and they're now extensively used in the Murray-Darling Basin to get some idea of how well we're travelling with things like environmental flows and in the management of our wetlands of national and international importance. So it's really useful to get this sort of data for a free-flowing river like the Buller, and also because it so rarely comes into New South Wales, we can get a good idea for future in terms of the management and importance of that Karrapundi Swamp and the Buller Overflow.
Richard Kingsford, who is a river ecologist and conservationist biologist, speaking to Catherine Spackman. It's time for the markets now. First up is Blackall, where Sam Hart is at the sale yards.
Good afternoon. Numbers were back to 3,000 head for the weekly Blackall Prime and Store sale. Quality improved on the 1,500 head of prime cattle yarded, and the return of multiple southern exporters saw prices improve by 20 to 40 cents. Very good quality runs of feeder steers and heifers saw gains of 20, and restocker yearlings also gained on last week. Good quality lightweight restocker steers topped at 536.2 to average 516, and heavy feeder steers sold to 476.2 to average 471. Medium weight preg tested empty heifers to the restocker made to 446.2 to average 408. Heavy heifers to the processor averaged 421. Grown steers lifted 34 cents, selling to 454.2 to average 434. And medium cows made to 411 to average 383. Heavy cows gained 18 cents, selling to 425 to average 401. And heavy bulls averaged 390 cents. It's been Sam Hart, the National Livestock Reporting Service.
And Errol Luck has the details from the weekly Warwick sheep sale.
Supply of stock at Warwick increased to 1,485 lambs and 948 grown sheep. With the extra numbers, most of the processors were able to operate, which improved prices on heavy lambs and mutton, with trade lambs selling to strong prices and restocker lines also selling to dearer trends. Young lambs, the 12 to 18 range, to restocker sold from 101 to 128, and young lambs in the 16 to 18 range, the butcher trade sold from 160 to 185, with those over 18 kilos at 206 to 254. Older lambs in the 18 to 20 range to feed sold at 199 and to the butcher trade at 187 to 210. Light trade lambs sold from 179 to 250. Heavy trade lambs to processors sold from 191 to 310, with the best of heavy lambs topping at 335. Dorper and crossbred hoggers to processors sold from 144 to 228. Lightweight crossbred used to restocker sold from 65 to 100, and the heavy used to processors sold from 150 to 210. Merino weathers were skinned to restocker sold from 96 to 193. Heavy weathers to processors sold from 185 to 248. This has been Errol Luck, MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
That's all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company. Now, before I go, I want to ask you a favour for tomorrow's show from midday. I want you to think of your favourite song to listen to in the car or in your harvester. Maybe it's when you're picking mangoes. I'm not sure, but tell me your favourite, your go-to song when you're doing work, because I'll be asking for it during tomorrow's show. I'll be back on your airwaves from midday. News is up next. It's 1 o'clock.